Hi, this is Bob Sorrentino from Italian Roots and Genealogy, and I'm here today with Frank Passara from Baltimore. So welcome, Frank. Thanks for being here.
It's good being here, Bob. Thank you for having me.
So I usually start with asking people about their history a little bit, but in your case, I think I'm going to start with you, that you told me a few minutes ago that you go back and forth to Italy on a regular basis, yeah?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I'm a primary resident in Narni, in the province of Terni in Umbria. We're in southern, central Italy. Actually, the geographic center of our town is, our geographic center of Italy is in our town.
Really?
So, yeah.
Wow.
They have a marker there. It's funny because Rieti was always saying, in Lazio, was saying that they were the center. One of my uncles went to the National Military Group and had them do a survey. And they found out that it was only a few miles from Narni. So you can get to everywhere from us or to us from everywhere. We're about an hour and 15 minutes from Rome, between Rome and Assisi. So it's rather nice. I'm in the mountains. I think I sent you a picture of the view from my balcony.
So that's really fantastic. So now, did you know growing up that you had family there in Italy?
Yes, yes. My family is two-pronged. My dad was Italian on both sides, but he was born in the United States. My mom was Italian on her father's side. She was born in Grenoble, France. And maybe we can get into that story a little bit later. But she had a rather interesting childhood where her father kidnapped her, and a parental kidnapping. And she died just recently in 2019.
Wow, that's something. You know, we don't think about kidnappings taking place that long ago.
No, in Mussolini's Italy, if you were an Italian male, you had certain privileges. So, and being said her mother was French, she had no privileges with my mother in Italy. So, again, if you want to go through that, I'm happy to do it.
That's an interesting story.
Let's start with Mom then. Mom was born in Grenoble, France, April 4th, 1929. She was born to my grandmother, whose name was Georgette. Okay. Georgette's last name was Guerra, which doesn't sound French. It sounds almost Spanish. So we're not sure. I've not been able to find too much on her. She was 13 when my mother was born. My grandfather was 30. And he was a mechanic living with his brother in France because there was no work in Italy at the time. And when my great-grandmother, Madame Lafault, I'm not sure what her first name was, but she found out about this. My grandfather had been dating her older daughter. And she forced the wedding. Okay, let's just say it that way. My grandmother was either 13 or 15. She was underage. Yeah. So it was a shotgun wedding. And after a couple of years, my grandfather got tired of that, obviously. And he took my mother. And it's interesting because I did some research. I talked to a guy in Narni whose father knew my grandfather. And he wanted to meet me because he said he had a story for me. And he remembered his father talking about coming back from France with my grandfather and my mother and them having to lock my mother in a closet in the train while the conductors came by in order to keep her from being returned to France. Once they crossed the border, they were fine. He got to Narni, where he left my mother with my grandmother, his mother, my great-grandmother. And she raised her, okay, for a few years. Then my mother went to live with other relatives when my grandmother passed. And those other relatives became her family until she turned 20. When she turned 20, my grandfather had gone to Ethiopia to fight in the war. He was captured by the British. He was a character, Bob. Obviously, I've heard stories where he was in a prisoner of war camp with the British. And he was trying to get them to send him home. So he tried to prove that he was crazy. So one of the commandants at the place gave him a task to do with some trees or something. And rather than plant them all, he cut them all. Okay. And he could have been shot, but they ended up sending him home because he was crazy. Anyway, he moved back into Narnia and wanted my mother to move in with him and a woman with whom he had another child. And my mother didn't want anything to do with that. So, like, my one aunt who lived in the United States had a friend whose son was going out with a girl with red hair. And that, in those days, was not a good thing. My grandmother, on my father's side, was very superstitious. It felt out that red hair was a no-no. Okay? It's funny, she was a church-going Catholic, Bob, but she was anti-cleric to the point where when my cousin went into the convent, she wouldn't talk to her until she came out. Okay? And she had multiple superstitions. And she sent my father on a trip to Italy after the war in 1948 to see his cousins. And he was supposed to stop and drop a letter at this place in Narnia to a friend's family. My father just wanted to go on through. But the family there said, come up, you got to meet the family. And my father saw my mother for the first time. And as the legend goes, you know, the lightning bolt and the Godfather, hope of the full moon. Well, that supposedly happened to my father, not my mother. My mother and her cousin stood behind the curtains and laughed at him. But they communicated for a year. My mother had a boyfriend there, but she decided to marry my father and come here to get away from her father. And in 1949, when you came, they married in June. June 16th, 1949, came. She lived with my grandmother, and she was supposed to go meet her mother for the first time. Okay, her mother had come to Narnia a couple of times, but they wouldn't let her see my mother. She was supposed to meet her mother for the first time when we went to Grenoble, France in 1957. And I was four, my brother was one. We went to Europe to see my grandmother before she died. We went in June. She died in April. I'm sorry, she died in May.
Wow.
So we never really got to meet her. But we've always said that that story is something for a romantic novel, or at least a tragic novel. My mother always wanted it written. I wanted to be able to do that. I've been looking for a ghostwriter, but they tend to cost a little bit much. So I might do some stuff on digital things like StoryCorps and other places to be able to save this story.
That's really something. I mean, 13, even 15. That's
It was a big difference, and it was
at 30, no less. Not, we're not talking 18 or 19. We're talking 30.
Right. He could have gone to jail, okay?
Yeah, of course, yeah.
And if he was living today, he would be in jail. But he was a gambler. He gambled away most of my mother's inheritance. There were only a couple of stores that she kept because her family was pretty well-to-do in Italy. In the United States, we were middle-class 1950s kids growing up with a father who worked in a shipyard and a mother who stayed at home. She went to work when we were going to high school because I went to a place called Calvert Hall here in Baltimore, which is a private boys' high school. And my brother was going too, so my mother went to get a job. Here she was with a teaching credential from Italy, and she was working as a clerk in a drugstore that my uncle owned for $1.25 an hour. They made some tremendous sacrifices.
People thought differently back then. It was certainly not like today. But you should do the story. I just got published with this last week. That's the book behind me. Yeah.
Okay.
The story of my families and my research and
that's excellent.
So yeah, you should definitely. whether you publish it or not, you should definitely write it all down, because that's
I want my grandson to have it.
Yes, absolutely. Of course. You know? Yeah.
Because the other side is interesting, too. They were more traditional. My grandfather, on my father's side, was born in Nusco, provincia di Avellino, in Campania. And he had a sister and two brothers. And they, you know, back in 1999, I think it was, when the Ellis Island site first opened. I don't know if you even tried, but back in those days, you got on the computer and you waited and you waited and you waited until something came up. And the first thing that popped up was my grandfather's family when I put in Pissarro. And they had immigrated here through Bermuda. And I'm still trying to figure out why. They said that they were in pretty bad shape in 1906 in Italy, and they were coming here. One of my cousins over there told me a story of how his grandfather supposedly was gypped, or great-grandfather was gypped by a landed person, and the property was stolen from him, more or less. The guy came down from the town in a white suit. The guy said, "Oh, I like the white suit." And the guy said, "Come on up. We'll get you a white suit." He gets the white suit and signs a paper thinking that this is thanks for the white suit. What it was, it was the deed to his farm.
Wow. And
according to this uncle, or this cousin, he died of a broken heart. And that would have been my grandfather's grandfather. Okay. So when he died, the family split off. It was around 1906. And my one uncle came in 1904. My grandfather's sister-in-law was here. Or my great-grandfather's sister-in-law was here. They came in through Ellis in November or May 20th, 1906. We celebrated that while my dad was still alive at the Sons of Italy Lodge here in Baltimore.
And Bermuda is interesting because I've heard a lot of stories about a lot of people coming in through different ways into different ports. But was it a British ship by chance?
It was the Hamiltonian. It was the Hamiltonian. It came directly from Hamilton. And my wife and I went on a cruise. I'm not a real big cruiser, but my wife likes it. And I said, "I'll only go if you go to Bermuda. And I can go to Hamilton and check on my nonnos, why they came through." The Hamilton Railroad was built before that was finished and stopped being used in 1924. So I don't know what happened. But they said they went to South America. And I can't find any record of anything south of Bermuda. So to Italians who were rather uneducated in geography, let's say, who wouldn't have had an elementary education, Bermuda could be South America.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah. I suppose it could be, right.
You know, I don't know.
That's interesting. Unless they brought them there thinking there would be work there, and then there wasn't, and then
that's possible. That's possible, because then they came in through, I never thought about it that way, but that's really possible. Then they came in through Ellis. The family stayed here. My grandfather went back in 1911 because the way he told my father was a telephone pole fell beside him while he was working on the railroads in Baltimore. I think he was working on the streetcars, mm-hmm. and they were putting up the poles, and the pole fell next to him. So he didn't feel safe working there anymore. He went back to Italy. He stayed in Nusco while he was there and then joined the Carabinieri. And when you're a Carabinieri in Italy, you can't serve in the same region that you sign up in because they're trying to stay away from corruption. Okay, so he was stationed in Porto Santo Pidio in La Marche. There, according to my aunt, My grandmother saw him in his uniform and turned to her sister. And she had a couple of sisters. She turned to her and said, I'm going to marry that guy. And he's a handsome guy. And he stayed there until the end of the First World War. And that's where that picture of him, we think that's him, in Trento in 1918. It's on the Armistice Day. As a matter of fact, that picture showed up on the Carabinieri site, a part of it. And I wanted to try to see if I could get confirmation on that. So I called them while I was in Rome. Unfortunately, they said that those were pictures that they just had generically. Mm-hmm. Because that picture was on a postcard that my grandfather sent to my grandmother of four Carabinieri all there. My grandfather, my father identified him as, yes, that is my father. They had a bicycle corps in the First World War. It was the only time they used bicycles. And he was a messenger to and from the Austrian front, which if you do any reading on that particular theater of World War I, it was as bloody or bloodier than the front in the West, because the Italians hated the Austrians and the Austrians had no use for the Italians. And battles like Caporetto and those battles along the Isonzo Plains, they were bloodbaths. There were very few places that you could hide.
We'll be right back.
Italian Roots and Genealogy is proudly sponsored by Your Dolce Vita and Dawn Matera, connecting people to their purpose in life and continuing their legacy. For more information, contact Dawn at www.yourdolcevita.com.
Yeah, and you know, to your point, I did, I don't know if somebody I talked to or where I heard it, but I did hear that those are very, very tough battles, yeah, between the Italians and the Austrians, yeah.
Yeah, there's a book called Isonzo that my cousin recommended in Italy, and I found it in English. And I was reading on it, and it just went back and forth and back and forth. I think there were 16 different changes of land. I want to go up to the area just as a pilgrimage, okay, because they've got a number of World War I museums up there, and it's phenomenal. The historical piece, and you might know, history is my passion.
Me too, yeah, I like history a lot.
I was a global history teacher at the high school where I graduated for the last 16 years of my career, and I spent time researching a lot of this stuff. So I'm hoping that I can go forward.
Right. I would imagine that hatred back then had to do with, you know, the Austrians, you know, ruling over a good chunk of Italy.
Right. The Austrians and the French, the nationalism that was prevalent at that time led to extreme hate. I don't want to say them. It was hatred, but it was extreme emotion between those places that still exists, I'm afraid. Especially now with nationalism resurging, I hear a lot of anti-French or anti-Austrian, anti-German particularly. Mm. Part of that is economic.
Yeah, yeah. And I know there's even a movement in Italy now to do what the British did, to get out of the European Union.
There was. It was stronger 5 years ago.
So you spent 6 months out of the year there, right?
Yes, sir. For the last 2 years particularly. I was there during COVID in 2020 because I had the passport. I only spent 3 months, though, because going back and forth was very difficult then.
Yeah, yeah. So now do you have citizenship or
yes.
You do?
In 2018, I achieved citizenship. It took me about 3 years and about $5,000. It was an interesting process because I've always wanted to do it, but I never thought I could I could jump through all the hoops. Going through the hoops is like working for a doctorate at one of the major universities. They're trying to discourage you. Okay, yeah. I never finished my doctorate. I was ABD, all but dissertation. And anyone will tell you that that's not a good thing.
No, I guess not.
No, but this was my dissertation. I spent 3 years getting. First, I went to an attorney in New York. Then I dumped him because he wasn't very much help in Philadelphia. Every consulate has different rules. And Philadelphia's was tougher because the middle Atlantic states have more people that want to become Italian citizens than anywhere in the country. I found out, I went in thinking that I had all the documentation, and the person at the consulate basically said, no, you need this. It's got to be documented. Translated. I had to go to the Secretary of State for the state of Maryland for a lot of documentation to be able to, you know, say that this was in fact my father's birth certificate. Biggest challenge I had was my father was referred to as Aero Frank Pissarro. My grandmother, I told you, was a little different. She named my father after a Greek god, and she home delivered. In her little house on, it was called Paradise Avenue or something. She moved to Clinton Street later in Baltimore. But my dad, the midwife there, wrote Erco, E-R-C-O. And my father had it changed to Frank when he was in the service to make it sound less Italian.
That's Italian, yeah.
Right. So trying to get to prove that Aero Frank Pissarro was the same as Frank Pissarro was our challenge. Finally, a birth certificate from St. Leo's Church in Little Italy here, baptismal certificate, I mean, put us over the top.
Yeah, and you know, it's funny you mentioned that because I'm working on it now. I'm working with an attorney myself. And I got my father's birth certificate from New Jersey. He was born in New Jersey in Scotch Plains. And it came back saying that his birthday was July 16th or something, 1923. And his birthday's April 7th. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, oh, wait a second. This doesn't make any sense.
Right.
So I asked my sister, I said, do you know what's going on? And she said, no, and she sent me, like you said, a baptismal certificate, another birth certificate, not from the state of New Jersey, but from Scotch Plains, saying mm-hmm. his birthday was April 7th. So now we have two different set documents, one saying his birthday is one day, and one saying his birthday is the other day. And I think what happened is, you know, we're talking 1923 now, mm-hmm. right? So I think what probably happened is that the town clerk or whatever recorded the birth as April 7th. And when he sent that document to the state,
mm-hmm.
instead of putting the birth date, he put the date that he sent the document.
Exactly. Exactly.
So now we're going to have to deal with that nonsense.
Yeah. It's challenging, but the consulate, at least in my case, I found that if I became too much of a pest, they wanted me gone. So, the lady was a sweetheart, though. She really did help me a lot. And it was frustrating because when you try to call in, they really don't want to talk to you until you have all the documents in your hands.
Yeah, I've heard that. Yeah,
so what I might suggest is that you do as much as you can to reconcile and make sure that you can prove that your father is the same person on both certificates.
Yeah. Well, I have a... And I just found this out not that long ago. I have a cousin from my dad's family that's an attorney with the consulate in San Diego. So mm-hmm. he said, so when you get the paperwork done, call me.
That's great. That's great.
I'm hoping I have a fast track now.
Are you in California?
No, we're in New York, but he said, don't just call me.
Okay. Yeah, well, he'll call the people in San Diego. in Philadelphia. Yeah, that's great, because I even tried to sneak in through Washington, D.C., because half of Maryland is in the D.C. Area. It's covered by the main embassy. And the other half of Maryland's covered by Philadelphia. They're really strict about you coming in through the area.
Yes, yeah.
You're in New York and Philadelphia, where a lot of our generation Italians lived.
Yeah, and somebody told me they used to be able to do it through, I think, Newark in New Jersey, and they closed it and they stopped it.
You used to be able to. There's a honorary consulate in Baltimore too, but they can't do the work.
Oh, I see. Yeah. I know it's not easy. I mean, I'm doing it. I hope I get it soon, but I'm doing it mostly now for the kids.
I did it for my kids, and both of them were accepted, but neither of them have gone for the passport yet. It's been 4 years. My one son's in cybersecurity. I think he's afraid that he'll lose his clearance. And my other son, I say it, he goes, yeah, you know, I really have to do that. And then he never does it. So, you know. It's a little bit disheartening, but at least I know that they have it. And if my grandson wants to get it when he gets older, it'll be there.
Well, for the grandson, he could go to school in Italy. And
that's what I'm...
Oh, it's so much cheaper.
Not only cheaper, but in many cases more... broadening. As an educator in the United States, I've worked in public and private schools. We have a very good system. Okay, don't let anybody ever fool you. However, the system in Italy is even tighter. I was talking to the electrician, okay, who was putting in my internet in Italy, and we were talking romantic poetry from the 19th century, okay? He had a liberal arts background out the bazoo, and he really knew his stuff. I find that very impressive. I think people should be well-rounded.
I didn't know that. I do know, I have a cousin and a friend that grew up in my town, and I just connected with him a couple of years ago when I interviewed him about his book. And they were, you know, they went to school in Italy. Mm-hmm. And the amazing story that I think it was Dr. Visco told me the story that there's no written exam for doctors in Italy. It's all oral.
All their exams are oral.
Really? Yeah. So that's a lot tougher than sitting there writing, right?
In a way, I would have liked to have done that. I did an oral. When I was going for my doctorate, I did a thing with a panel there. It's really a neat experience. And the trick to it is you get them arguing among themselves and you don't have to say a whole lot. The written part I found more challenging for me. But I guess it's different for everybody.
And the interesting thing. It may have been Gene. I don't remember which one told me, but he said he was taking the test, and he said, with the doctors, they brought in three people, or three or four, and they would ask you a question, and you would answer that part, and then they would say to the next person, "Okay, tell me something different."
Right. Yeah.
And then they were the next person and tell me something different. And in fact, I think it was Gene. And he said the question that they asked, he said, "I don't know how I remembered this, but I remembered that it had something to do with a venereal disease."
Mm-hmm.
And I spat that out. I was the last one to go, and I spat that out, and they were all jumping up and down congratulating me.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
And then he said there was another guy that the teacher told him to go to the blackboard and write something.
Mm-hmm.
And he wrote across the blackboard, and he got to the end of the blackboard, and he said, "What do I do now?" He says, "Keep writing till you get to the door and leave." I guess that's a subtle way of saying that you didn't pass.
You passed. Congratulations.
Or you failed. One or the other. So now, have you done a lot of research in Italy into the families there?
Yes, particularly my mom's side. I don't drive anymore, so I take trains in Italy when I'm there. I've done research at Narni, and I've done research at Porto Santo Pidio. I haven't been to Nusco since 2004. When I was in Nusco, I did pick up a family tree that goes all the way back to 1580. That one of my cousins, who I met for the first time, I was the first family member from the United States to come in 50 years. But I found a cousin who was a professor at a university near Naples who had done a researched family tree of firstborns. So I do have that for my grandson and for my older son. I was really happy about that. In Narni, my grandfather was a personaggio. He was a character. He opened the first open-air theater, okay, or drive-in, as you would call it.
Yeah, right.
It was actually a sit-in because they had seats, but it was all outside. And there were two of them in Narni at the time. And the one guy was advertising for his place, which was in the center of town. It was very considered the best place. And he said, "We've got the best films from all over Europe." My grandfather put signs outside his place. "I've got the worst films from all over Europe. And you don't want to come here." So, like I said, he was a character. I tell you what, he was a very smart man, and this is what gets me. He was a mechanic. Because of his various, let's say, experiences through life, he came up with some nasty diseases. And those nasty diseases cost him his arms and his legs. His legs first. But when he was just an upper trunk of a person, he designed a handbrake on a Fiat so that he could still drive a car.
Wow.
This was 1952, you know?
Wow, that's awesome.
I don't think we did stuff like that on cars anywhere until probably now.
So what year, I'm intrigued by the open air theater. What year was that, that they had these things?
It was the 50s. I have a picture of it in Narni, but I don't have that with me here. But it was just a whole lot of chairs sitting out on a balcony, a very large balcony, and a screen, and they would run the pictures. They still do some of that in Narni. We have a theater that runs films. We had Tom Cruise's Mission Impossible while I was there at the beginning of the summer. So, you know, it was something then, and it's still something now. I'm hoping that, like I said to you before we got on, I'm hoping to be able to bring some people to Narni because it's such a great place. We have an underground that they found in the 1970s under San Domenico Church. And San Domenico was over top of this Inquisition torture chamber that nobody had seen until the 1970s. A group of kids were going through and they fell through a hole, and they found some stuff and they started digging, and they've been digging for the last 50 years. It's called Narni Sotterranea, and people come from all over Europe to see it.
Wow, that's something. Yeah.
We also have a beautiful church, and I think I sent you a picture of the inside of the Duomo. It's where my mom and dad were married in the 1940s. We have a number of beautiful churches, a wonderful museum. Our rocca, or fortress on top of the hill, is not as touristy as the one in Spoleto, but it was the pieces there were all made by the Cardinal Albernaz, who was a liaison to the Pope. And they had one in Tunisia, one in Narnia, one in Spoleto, and one as they went into Austria. And when the popes went in and out of the Vatican, they would stop in these places so that they would be safe from bandits and other people. So that's really cool. We also have a bridge that the remnants are still there. It wasn't destroyed in World War II. The bridge was built by Caesar Augustus in 31 BC. The Ponte Agosto was a traffic bridge over the Nera River. Nera is a branch of the Tiber. And it was built as a monument to Augustus's win over Mark Antony and Cleopatra between Greece and Egypt. And so it's got a lot of history there. It's got a lot of history there.
Yeah, it sounds like a fascinating place. And I know you mentioned the church. That was the one thing that we found really amazing when we were there in June, was when you go into these churches, even in the smallest towns, they're beautifully kept up, clean, flowers everywhere. I mean, the pride that are taken in these places, and, you know, to think that some of them are 1,800 years old or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's just amazing.
Yeah, and even the bridge, it's all marble. You stand next to it, it's amazing.
It's marble.
Marble Actium, I think that was it.
It's a marble bridge?
It's a marble bridge.
Wow. Yeah.
And you stand next to it, and you're looking up, and you're wondering, how the heck did they get the stones that high? But the town is built on a precipice, Bob. I mean, my father always marveled at this, because my grandfather and he were both stonemasons, and they come off the edge of a mountain, and they come straight up off of the mountain. The middle school is right over top of that, and so is the museum. And across the way, there they found ancient woolly mammoth tusks, okay, in the mountain, okay? So there were animals there before people, obviously, okay? And the people moved in, hunted these animals to extinction, and then formed new societies on top of them. It's a whole different world. The United States has a lot of really good things going for it in terms of natural resources, in terms of things that you can see, but in terms of antiquity, you got to remember what is now the United States is only 200 years old.
Right.
But what was here before them were great civilizations, but they were mostly destroyed by conquest. There's very little antiquity here, and you can see a great deal in Italy and in most of Europe, all of China, India. Okay, and I'd like to use this in my last years now before the good Lord comes and takes me away to see some of these wonders of humanity.
Yeah, I know exactly. I know exactly how you feel. You know, we lived in England for 2 years in the 90s. Yeah, we lived in Bournemouth, about 90 miles south of London. Mm-hmm. And to your point, it's different when you live someplace than when you're just visiting.
Right.
Because you become part of it more than anything else, and that's the way we felt. Of course, England was a little bit better because the language was close, not exact, but it was close. And we would just, on Sundays, we would just take a drive out into the countryside and we'd see one of these manor houses from 1500 mm-hmm. or 1600 that a lot of them were open. And you would just go in there and just be amazed at first the architecture and the craftsmanship and all of that. And in some of them, they were like museums filled with paintings of the families from 300-400 years. And we used to laugh because you know they would have the all the dukes and the counts, their portraits lined up. They all look the same. Mm-hmm. The clothes are different.
Yeah, one of my joys as a teacher was in the summertime, occasionally being able to take kids to travel. And before I was at the high school where I left, I was an administrator and a teacher in public schools. I would take kids from some areas of Baltimore that never got out of Baltimore. I would take them to New York to see a play. And we took our eighth grade with some monies that we had gotten through the county. And watching the kids dress up to go to a theater in New York was a joy. Okay, and kids would come back and they'd have expanded horizons. They'd want to do stuff. One of my assistant principals took a group to Gettysburg. Okay, same thing. They had never been outside of they were like 13, 14 years old, and they had never been out of Baltimore. Well, as a teacher at Calvert Hall, I got to take kids to London, Paris. One of my colleagues took them to Madrid. We took them to Dublin. We took them to Rome, Florence, and Venice. And just watching them grow from that, even as far away as nearby as Quebec. Quebec was awesome.
I've been there. Yeah, it's a neat place.
It's the most European city in North America. And you do get different perspectives on people. It's a whole lot like listening to people talk about Maloney here. And people will tell you, I'm not a big fan of the right wing, but I've been close enough to people who understand what she wants to do, to understand why they want to do it. Mm-hmm. With people in the United States, it's hard to have that conversation because the people who want change don't know why they want that change.
Yeah.
You can't explain it to me.
I hear you. And, you know what's sad here, and I just learned about this recently, Birthright Israel. I don't know if you ever heard of them.
But, yes, I have.
And in fact, yeah, I was talking to my neighbors across the street, and both their kids went. And a couple of us are trying to see if we could get something started. There are one or two groups who send a small, very select group of kids, 18 to 26, over to Italy. But they've sent, I think 750,000 kids who wouldn't have had the chance to Israel.
It's awesome.
And we don't have anything like that. It's sad. I mean, it was as large as our community is with, people with money, and to try and get something like that started is just so difficult. And, my kids are adopted. They're young, much. They could be my grandkids, probably. They're in their 20s, 26, 27. And I wasn't sure when we took them how they were going to feel about it, whether they were going to connect. And they loved it. They just ate it up. And it's sad that we don't get enough of our youth to Italy.
I understand that because I took my boys back in the early 2000s. To see the places where their people came from. They were in, my one son was around 10. The other one was, by the time we went, was about 20. Unfortunately, they didn't seem to remember much. However, I took them back in 2015 and we spent, a week together traveling through Italy, and they could see why I loved it there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And, I'm hoping that once things calm down a little bit, we're able to do that. Between COVID and some of the other stuff that's going on, it's been a challenge to travel, vaccinations and all the other things.
Yeah. But, and it's not just the places, it's the people.
Yeah.
It's different. And it's hard to put in words, but it's different. And, everybody that we saw, they were... and that's the thing. They were excited that we wanted to be there and to know and to understand our culture.
Well, it's interesting because my mother's half sister, she was born when my mother left Italy. And my mother was really didn't want to go back to that era again.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Yeah, I could understand. Yeah.
Unfortunately, I took her back there. Okay, when I started going over every year for about 3 weeks and staying with my half aunt, half aunt, who wanted to reconnect with my mother. So I was staying with her, and she's been a joy to my life. She's just her and her family. I've become godparents to her children's children, and I'm a godparent to her grandson. I was in the daughter's wedding. So, and my mother eventually went back, but the welcoming that she gave me, okay, was tremendous. And then when I bought the house, my cousin Lorenzo, who helped me, it still helps me to keep an eye on the house. He lives across the street from the house that I bought. Got me a place, found me a place all on one floor that my wife will go to. It's been a blessing. And you're right. And the people have accepted me. They said, I'm more Narnese now than I am Americano.
I know.
And though I am both, and I can tell both. I think my part of my heart is really there.
And when we were in Montebello, I think it was Vincenzo. I think that's who it was. He gave me a cup of dirt,
mm-hmm.
and he said, "You take this home."
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's sitting up there on the shelf,
right,
in a nice little glass jar. But that's how much it means to them. That's why I said it's sad that with all the people here in Hollywood and sport and all of this stuff that pat themselves on the back all the time, that they haven't come up with a program, or we as a community
come
up with a program to send kids that would never have the opportunity to go. If it's different with us, you know, if you have the money and you can do it,
right.
But a lot of people can't.
And especially families that, young families, you really need to get there when you're in your 40s.
Yeah.
And then you get the feel, and you go a couple of times. I agree with you. And if you ever decide to start this up, maybe we can start it up through Mio. Get Matt Platanio on board.
Yeah, no, I did mention it to him, and we're going to be working on something else, I think, soon. But there are a few people interested. The problem is that the big groups, really big groups, don't seem to want to help the little groups. But we'll overcome it. I understand.
You know, and that's the difference I find between an American mentality and an Italian mentality. Americans are very individualistic, and Italian Americans tend to be very individualistic. I've worked hard for what I've got, okay, and I want to hold on to that for myself and my kids. And I understand that point of view. I don't necessarily agree with it all the time. On the other hand, in Italy, what I find is it's more community-based. They really want, not only for themselves and their kids, but for their community, their small region. And perhaps that's a feature of the U.S. that came out of the largeness of the United States, where Italy is much smaller and more compact. I'm not sure how else to really explain that.
No, I know what you mean. I know what you mean. And they've been there for, you know, 300, 400, 500 years.
Right.
So it's right. You know, to your point, it's a completely different mentality. When I talk to Nicola Mastronati, he's an expert on the Samnites, and mm-hmm. I said, well, wow. You know, where's your family? My family's here 500 years. In this valley, in this area, so that I know of, that
right.
He knows of, that they're 500 years, mm-hmm. and to him, he's, you know, considers himself part of this Samnite nation that goes back to 3,000 years before Christ.
You know, and that's a gift that my mother gave me. When I was young, she always used to talk about how we extend back to the Romans. And that's interested me in history. probably made my career. You know, you're right. There is a connection there. And I never wanted to lose my Italian-ness. Okay. I have relatives who, when I talk about stuff like this, oh, why are you so interested in that? We're American now. I really love my American political group, system. I love our country. I love what we purport to be. However, I also love who I am as an Italian. And that dual citizenship, to me, is a really important piece of that.
I know exactly how you meant. I never really felt it. And, you know, I think you mentioned it earlier about, you know, the town you're from. And that's what they told me. They told me, now you're from Montebello. Now you're from Fossato.
Right.
And it was genuine. It wasn't just, it wasn't bullshit.
Exactly.
You know,
it's interesting. My neighbors over there, we stay in touch even in the wintertime. One of them is with city councilman there. When Forza Italia, which is a far, Americans would consider a far right group. It's part of Berlusconi's group. I've got friends on both ends of the political spectrum that I talk to. And it's a fun talk because we'll talk and they may even yell at you and say, you know, say stuff to you that here would keep you from talking to people for the next 20 years. And you're talking the next day like it didn't happen. Because you know, in their hearts, they believe that, and you know in their hearts who they are. And I feel that we've lost some of that here.
I was just going to say that. I think we lost a lot of that. Sadly, we did lose a lot of that. Well, Frank, this has been fantastic. I love talking about this stuff. I enjoyed this conversation, especially the history part, because I think that's why I eventually got started. I always liked history. Probably one of my best subjects. Math, not so much, but history I did pretty good in.
I understand. I wasn't a math guy either, though. I went through trigonometry, and they wanted me to go into pre-calculus. And I said, no, thank you. And that was the last math class I took until I took a stats class in my graduate program. I understand, Bob. It's very much. I'm talking to you as well. Okay, thank you. And I hope that you'll keep the lines open. Maybe we can do this again sometime.
Absolutely. And, you know, if we get this thing started where we could start sending some kids over there, I'll keep you in mind.
Some neat photos there of the whole family around my grandmother's kitchen table back in the 1950s.
Yeah, those are great photos. I love those photos. Yeah. And, I'll intersperse them and I put some on the blog.